You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Good morning, everybody. What a privilege it is to start the second day of the conference, the first full day of the conference, and I would like to tell you how grateful I am to be here and how much I've appreciated the hospitality of everyone who I've encountered. You've all been very warm and gracious and encouraging. Last night, I did mention that I like Tim Hortons. I am from Canada, but I do live in Los Angeles, and there are no Tim Hortons in Los Angeles. Every once in a while, I do Google Tim Hortons near me, and it shows me, like, on Google Maps, it takes me all the way, like, to the other side of the continent or way up into British Columbia. And so I mentioned last night that I really was excited to see so many Tim Hortons here, but they were all closed. Nevertheless, when I got here this morning, Sandra had a Tim Hortons ready for me. Yeah. So I started to think, you know, I just mentioned that I like Tim Hortons and I got a Tim Hortons, so I came up with a list of other things. I like a Tempur-Pedic mattress, iPhone 16, an 85-inch plasma TV, and a signed Eddie George football. If you were here last night, it was pretty abstract, and it was maybe like getting a drink from a fire hydrant. Today, it will be very concrete and very practical, and what we're going to talk about today is the power of listening, but specifically to those who are going through a crisis of faith. It can be very daunting. It can be really fearful when someone comes to you and shares, hey, I'm really struggling with what I believe, and how do we go about answering those questions? I'm in the process right now of writing a book called From Heartbreak to Hope, Responding to a Loved One's Loss of Faith, because when I speak on this topic, oftentimes parents will come up to me and share their heartbreaking story of a son or a daughter who's left the faith, and sometimes the spouse will come up and tell me their story of their husband or wife who's left the faith. And if you listen to the stories of people who have left the faith, one of the things that there's a common thread that runs through all of them is that what has pushed them further away is the response that their parents or their spouse has made in responding to their declaration that they're struggling with their faith. So how do we go about engaging with somebody who is wrestling with faith questions? Last night I talked about deconstruction. And I want to encourage you, if you have the opportunity, to go hear Ian Harbor. He's going to talk about walking through deconstruction in one of the breakouts today. And we have the same view of deconstruction. It's when someone takes apart their faith, lays it on the table because they've had a crisis, and then they start to put it back together in ways that hopefully are more biblical. But sometimes deconstruction can end up leading to deconversion, where people who once identified as Christians say, I don't do this anymore. And again, when you find yourself discussing with someone who shares their story with you and says that I'm deconstructing, or you know what, I'm on the verge of deconverting, it can be a very challenging thing to know what to do. So the topic, how do we go about responding, is what we're going to take a look at this morning. And usually when there's a crisis, we don't respond all that well. If we learned anything from COVID, which was a respiratory disease that was very serious but had nothing to do with going to the bathroom, people ran to the stores and toilet paper was sold out everywhere because there was a panic. And so as you engage in dialogue, and as you engage with someone who comes and shares their faith with you, or their struggle with you, the first thing I want to say is keep calm. All right, keep calm, because the most important thing that we can do is to not overreact and to not be afraid that we're going to say the wrong thing, or not to try and bring somebody back really quickly into the fold by answering all of their questions. A number of years ago, my daughter was about 11 years old, and I was putting her down to bed, and we have our best conversations then. And she has a very strong personality. She's an independent thinker. And she said to me, you know what, Dad, I want to tell you something, but I think it's going to make you sad. And I said, that's okay, honey, you can tell me anything you want, and I promise that I'll still love you, and it might make me sad, but it's never going to be anything that will ever cause a rift in our relationship. And, oh, that's fine, you can just keep that one, that's good. She said, okay, well, I don't think that I believe in heaven anymore. And in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, her whole life flashed before me. I thought to myself, you're going to move to Las Vegas, you're going to become a pit boss, you're going to marry a Hell's Angel, and you're never going to darken the door of a church again, because in an instant, I went from, if you don't believe in heaven, then you probably don't believe in God, and if you don't believe in God, you don't believe in Jesus, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're not a Christian. And what does that look like going forward? And to be, I'm not kidding, there was a wave of anxiety that came over me when she said, I don't believe in heaven. Now, when I tell that story, my wife always says, you have to tell the end of the story. My daughter does believe in heaven today, but and she actually believed in heaven at the time. But what I found out by listening to her was that when she said she didn't believe in heaven, in her limited vocabulary, what she was really meaning was, granddad died earlier this year, and you say that he went to heaven, but I don't understand where he is. I don't understand what that means, and I can't imagine it. What she wasn't saying is that she doesn't believe that there is a place, but that she can't conceptualize it. And I only learned about that by listening to what she had to say. And so I want to encourage us, when someone that you love or someone that you know says, hey, I'm on the verge of maybe leaving the faith or I'm deconstructing the faith, don't panic. But instead, make the conscious decision to choose to listen and to listen well. And we're going to talk about the four steps in listening this morning. But before we do that, let's talk about the hindrances of listening. One is when we prejudge someone, when we sit down and we think we already know where they're coming from, we already know what they're going to say. And if you already know what someone's going to say, you're probably not listening well, but you're already formulating responses in your mind. And that's a real hindrance to listening. Another is being too quick to react. Maybe you feel as though they're mischaracterizing Christianity, or maybe they're mischaracterizing something that you said, and the natural tendency is to want to jump in and to correct that. We all have trigger words, right? When someone says to you, you should never do this, or you always do that, whenever we hear never and always, our immediate response is to say, really? You think I always do this and I never do that? So we want to be careful, and we want to make sure that we're going in and we want to avoid these two hindrances. The third is we don't want to ambush. We're not listening as a tool in order to try and create a set of statements that we can then use again later as a trap in order to try and get someone to see our point of view. When I was in my 20s, I used to work at a fitness facility for about a week. And I only worked there for about a week because I felt so uncomfortable with what they wanted me to do. They were much more interested in selling memberships than they were actually helping people get in shape. And in the process, after I was hired, they said, now here's what we want to do. When anyone ever comes into the facility, we want to make sure that as you're giving them the tour and as you're talking about the packages, that you ask them at least these three questions. Number one, is there anything more important than your health? Number two, is there anyone in your family who would not be encouraging you to get in better shape? And three, don't we make time for things that we really care about? And you know why they wanted me to ask those questions? Because when you push the contract across the table, the first response will always be, well, I'm not really sure about this. You know, it costs a lot of money. Yes, but didn't you already say that there's nothing more important than your health? I really should go home and talk to my spouse about this. But earlier you told me that there's no one in your life who wouldn't be encouraging you to get in better shape. But I'm not really sure at this point I have the time. But we make time for things that are important, don't we? Right? That was ambushing. That might work once in a conversation with someone, but people really pick it up really quickly, or at least that's what my wife tells me, right? We want to listen, not to ambush. And I think that this is, you know, when we engage in apologetics, sometimes this can be the case as well. We can be listening and we can be asking questions really just to set someone up to hopefully try and see things our way. I remember once in Los Angeles, in Santa Monica, where you might be familiar with the pier. It's got a carnival on it and the big Ferris wheel. And there's a place called the Third Street Promenade. It's a street with high-end stores, and it's closed off on both ends. And there's lots of people out performing and selling things on the street. There's different groups out there. And I was walking along, and there was a gentleman who was handing out flyers for a particular political fella years ago. And I thought, oh, he's out here evangelizing for this guy. I'm going to evangelize him for Jesus. And so I said to him, can you tell me about so-and-so? And so he says, oh, this is a really important political figure. He's the only hope that we have for humankind. Said, well, except for one, maybe. And then to my shame, this is how the conversation went. I was not interested in listening to him about this guy. I did not really care why he was out there, but what I was trying to do was get him to a place where I could ambush him. So I said, so then if you're out here because he's the only hope for humankind, why do you care about humankind? He said, well, I care about humankind because humans are valuable. I said, you know what? I agree that humans are valuable too. And then I said, so why do you think humans are valuable? And he said, well, I think humans are valuable because I think that there's a lot of goodness in people. I said, I think there's a lot of goodness in people too. Why do you think humans are good though? He said, well, I think that humans are good because they possess a soul. I said, I think that humans possess a soul too. And then I ambushed him. Where do you think they get their soul from? And he said, I don't know, and I have no idea. And then I said, so let's get this straight. You're out here because you care about humans. You care about humans because they're good. You care they're good because they have souls. You have no idea where the souls come from. So essentially what you're telling me is you have no idea why you're out here in the first place. You might be surprised to hear this. He did not become a Christian. But I ambushed him. We want to avoid ambushing people in conversations. So here's step one. If you find yourself in a place where you are having to have a difficult conversation with someone who's going through a crisis of faith, step one is asking yourself, what does this person believe? And to be able to do that, you have to desire to understand what they actually do believe. And desire it sincerely. The most effective part of being a good listener is really wanting to know where someone else is coming from. And wanting to know because they're made in the image and likeness of God. Wanting to know because you genuinely love them. So we really want a desire to know. The second thing is we want to ask questions and also offer some summary statements. Here are some helpful questions. Can you summarize your current thinking in one sentence? Where are you on this right now? What is it that you believe? Can you help me understand what it is that you hold to? And if you can do that in one sentence, that would be great, but succinctly. Number two, how do you identify at this point religiously? Are you someone who says, I'm in the process of rethinking and I'm struggling? Are you someone who says, no, I've actually come out the other side and I'm agnostic now. I just don't know what I believe, but I know it's not this anymore. Or are you someone who says, hey, I'm full-blown, I'm an atheist now. I've come to the place where I don't think that God exists at all anymore. Where are you in that process? Clarifying questions might be something like, what I hear you saying is, and then repeating back to them what you think that they said. And asking, is that correct? Because unless you are talking about the same thing they're talking about, then you're not having a conversation at all. You're not communicating. You're really talking past people. If I'm sitting on a plane and someone says, where are you going? And I say, I'm going to speak at a Christian conference in Ohio. And they turn to me and say, so you're a Christian, so you believe in God. And I say, well, I do. And they say, believing in God is really foolish. It would be wrong for me to immediately jump in and respond to them without asking them, a couple questions. Like the first would be, what do you mean by God? Because the concept of God they might have in their mind would not be the same concept I have in my mind. And until we have some common ground in that regard, then we're just talking past each other. Because if he thinks that God is a sort of a bearded deity in the sky who predetermines everything and is a moral monster and a malevolent bully and all of these kinds of things, then I say to him, you know what? You're right. I don't believe in that God. Let me tell you about the one that I believe in, and now maybe we can have some kind of a conversation. Third, do I understand you correctly that you are in process, that you are moved outside of the faith, Right? We want to ask really helpful, good questions to gain information. Here are some bad questions, though. And they're probably the ones that we're more inclined to ask. Something like this: how can you not believe in the resurrection? How in the world can you not believe that God is good and that God is loving? Trust me, most of the people who go through this process, the average time it takes from when a person starts to when a person leaves their faith is about 3 years. If it's anything shorter than that, then you are probably well within your rights to think that the faith that they held was not a very deeply rooted faith. If someone loses their faith in a weekend, it was probably never deeply rooted. But the average person who walks away from their faith spends about 3 years from the time that they started wondering to the time that they eventually leave. So they probably have asked a lot of these questions, and they may have looked into it fairly deeply. The internet has allowed 1,000 atheist apologists to bloom, and they may have looked into some of the things that they're struggling with deeper than we have. Sometimes people say things like, aren't you just angry at God because he did not, what, give you what you wanted? He did not provide a spouse for you. He has not given you a child. You didn't get into the college that you wanted to get into. Aren't you really just throwing an adult temper tantrum right now? You're not giving God what God wants. Not a helpful question to ask. Or turning it towards ourselves and saying, do you understand how much this hurts me? At some point, maybe if you're a parent or a spouse, that question for sure comes up. And to say, hey, you know, I understand you're going through this and this is hard for you, but this also affects me and it affects our family, and we need to be able to dialogue about this and to talk about that. But at the very beginning, we probably don't want to ask that kind of a question or say something like that. Is there sin in your life? The answer to that is always yes. There's always sin in our life. But for the most part, over and over again, the chief criticism of people who once identified as Christians and no longer do, they say that when they read Christian responses, they get very upset because they're always told they left because of sin, because they really just wanted to sleep with their boyfriend or girlfriend or do something that the Bible forbids, or that they just never really believed in the first place. Did you ever really believe? I have sat down and talked with people who have told me that they lost their faith, and this is very difficult to hear and hard to comprehend, but lost their faith with tears, praying, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. I had a gentleman email me last year and said, can I talk to you? I'm on the verge of leaving the Christian faith. He said, I think that it is the greatest story ever told. I think it is the only hope for mankind. I go to church on a regular basis because I want it to be true so bad, but I am convinced it's false. So before I finally leave, can I meet with you? I said, sure, where do you want to meet? He said, you tell me. I was assuming that he was local. He said, I'll fly out, and I'll pay you $200 an hour. And I said, I can't take the $200. I ended up talking to him for 5 hours, so I should have taken the 2 hours, so $200. He flew from the East Coast of the United States all the way out to Los Angeles, and we met at Biola University for about 5 hours. Hard for me to say that this guy didn't have, at least as far as I could tell and as far as he could tell, a genuine, sincere desire to believe and that it wasn't sin in his life. Have you really investigated the evidence for Christianity? Probably not a helpful question, because I suspect that many of them had. I recently interviewed a couple, both of whom worked at Biola University, who now say they're no longer Christians, and asked them, in your struggle, in your loss of faith, can you give me some advice that you would like Christians who engage with you to know? And the female said that when she went to try and talk to people about her doubts, there was no one really to talk to, and she was just told to read her Bible more. And she said, but that's the problem. I'm having a problem with the Bible. Like, in reading it more just makes me have more problems. She went on to say this: instead of trying to reconvert me, can you just sit with me in my pain? She says, look, it was like a 20-year marriage that I had with Jesus, and it was coming to an end. She said, I was in so much pain. Just sit with me. Don't try and bring me back into the fold. Just accept me and love me. And then she said, I would want Christians to know that there was no, at least on the surface, nefarious reason for what I was doing. Now, if we wanted to just step over here for a second and think about things theologically, we know that the Bible says that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked above all things. Who can know it? So is there always some heart component to these things? For sure there is. But charitably speaking, on the surface, she just said, look, I didn't want to lose my faith. And can you at least trust me that I am trying honestly to process that without immediately seeing me as being someone who is betraying you and betraying the faith? So the goal of the first step is just understanding what the person believes. Number two would be to ask, okay, why does this person believe what they believe? Here are some helpful questions. Right, what authors or individuals have helped shape your thinking? And this is an important question because very few people start off with their own original thoughts, but most of us encounter either the arguments for Christianity or the arguments away from Christianity from someone else, and there's lots of those out there today that people have access to that they never had in the past. And knowing who has influenced someone can really help you, because if someone says, well, it was Richard Dawkins, or if it was Sam Harris, or if it was, you know, some other well-known atheist, then you can perhaps find some responses to those folks online and maybe prepare yourself when you do eventually respond. Another question you might ask is, you know, when did you start thinking this way? How long has this process been going on? How long have you actually been suffering and struggling with and wrestling with this? Was there something specific that started bringing about your doubts? And there's always something specific that brings about doubts, right? There's always some event that takes place, and we're going to take a look at what some of those are in the lives of real people who I've encountered and talked with. What has convinced you that your new position is correct? Knowing these kinds of things can help you as you prepare a response if you are going to eventually at some point engage this person in dialogue. If you have a cell phone and you're taking notes, feel free to just take pictures if you'd like. That might be quicker. And for some of you, it would just be more like your natural habitat anyway. So, and then lastly, is your thinking still in process, or have you arrived at a settled position on this? Right? Are you inviting me into this conversation? Am I invited in to process this with you? Are you sharing this with me today because what are you looking for in this? Are you just wanting to get it off your chest? Are you saying, hey, you're my friend and you need to know this? Are you saying, I'm still wrestling and I want some help in this? In all of this, I think it's really helpful to say thank you to people who are willing to share this with you, because it can be a really, really painful experience when you want to believe something, but you just don't see how you can anymore. Sometimes people will say things like to me, hey, do you remember what it was like when you started to realize that Santa Claus didn't exist, even though you really wanted him to, but the real world crept in and there was no room in your worldview for both the real world and Santa Claus, and Santa Claus eventually just went away? And that's what it was like for me in my belief in the existence of God or the truth of Christianity. I just couldn't get past that. And that can be really hard. And so saying to someone, hey, thanks for sharing your story with me. Thank you for entrusting me with this. One parent group that I spoke with recently said that their son took them out for dinner and sat them down across the table and was literally shaking as he was trying to tell them that he didn't think that he was a Christian anymore. So telling people that we do appreciate and that we thank them for sharing their story with us, I think, is important. One thing to listen for in the process as well is something that sometimes is called a narrative injury. If you know anything about C.S. Lewis, you know that he was a staunch defender of the faith, but then something happened in his life. The woman that he fell in love with late in his life felt like she was a gift from God, got sick, and passed away, and he wrote this book called A Grief Observed. And in it, he takes a completely different tone. And he opens up his heart and he talks about how hurt he was and how he would go to God and he would cry out to God and he felt like God ultimately wasn't there. And he says, I never came to the place where I thought God didn't exist, but he said, I really wondered, okay, so is this the kind of God you are? Right? He experienced a narrative injury, which just means this, that in his life story, something came crashing in and caused him to see the world differently. The lenses that he was seeing the world through developed significant cracks in them. And in every story of deconversion, there is a narrative injury that is really important to try and uncover and to hear. Because for the majority of people who will tell you their story will almost always start with the engine of reason. But if you listen long enough, what you'll find is that it's probably not the engine of reason. In fact, reason might be the caboose that comes along afterwards to justify. Now, that's not the case for everyone. But if you read enough stories online and listen to enough people talk, and if you listen carefully, you'll find out that there's more going on there, that some narrative injury happened in their life. There was a catalyst that took place. And so let me share with you the four that are probably the most common. All right, so this is Mike. Mike would tell you that he left his belief in the existence of God because of reason. His brother Sean would argue with him all the time, and they would go back and forth, apologetics, counter-apologetics. But if you listen to Mike talk long enough, what you would find out is that really at the root of his loss of faith was in junior high when his dad passed away. And he was of Japanese-American descent. And he was the only Japanese-American descent in his school. And this is sort of, Mike's fairly old. This is, just after World War II. He's in junior high. And so he's looked at with suspicion, and he's made fun of, and he doesn't have a father. And so he will give you all kinds of reasons and all kinds of arguments for why God doesn't exist. But at the end of the day, Mike's rejection is grounded in his emotion. And I know that for a fact, because I know Mike, and I know the end of his story, which I'll share with you in just a minute. Then there is Dave. To be fair to Dave, we could put intellectual and heart up here. Because Dave got saved in high school, very passionate for Jesus, played drums in the worship band, went out doing all kinds of evangelism, deeply involved in the church. And he was standing in the baptismal tank, and the pastor said to him, "You know, Dave, this is a huge step that you're taking. You really got to know for sure that you're on Team Jesus." And Dave said to himself in the baptismal tank, "I've actually never really investigated if this stuff is all true. I bought into it, but now I'm being told I really got to know." So he said he got baptized. After the service was over, he went home, got out a Bible, and started reading from cover to cover. And by the end, he said, "There's no way in the world I believe in this God." Partially for intellectual reasons, but also partially for heart reasons. How I know this is because I interviewed Dave for my doctoral research, and when I was done, he said, "Now I want to interview you on my radio podcast." And I said, "Okay, I guess that's fair." He asked me on the show, "Why do you believe in God?" And I said, "Well, here are the reasons as best as I can discern it. There's probably lots of things in my life that I'm unaware of that push me in this direction, but here you go." And I said, "What would it take, Dave, for you to believe in God again?" He said, "You know what? If God rent open the sky and I saw him and he said, 'Here I am, I'm God,' he said, I would believe in him." I said, "What do you mean by believe?" He said, "I would affirm his existence." I said, "Okay, but would you rightly order yourself in a relationship with him where he's the creator, you're the creature, and that you submit to him as Lord?" And he said, excuse my language, "Hell no." So my response to him was, "Well, Dave, then you should be grateful that God doesn't give you more evidence to believe in him, because it's clear that it's not your intellect that's the problem here, that it's your will. And the more evidence God gave you would not change that. In fact, it would just make you more damnable because you are more responsible for the light that he's given you." But for him, the narrative injury came in his life when he actually picked up the Bible and started reading it and said, "Never knew a lot of that stuff was in there. Can't believe it, won't believe it." This is Linda. Linda's narrative experience injury happened when she was a young Christian woman. She had married a man. He was physically abusive to her. They had a child. He put both her and the child in the hospital. The church that she went to was a very toxic environment. They were spiritually abusive. And when she reached out to them for help, they told her that her lifestyle at that point, her being separated from her husband, was unbiblical and that they refused to help her. So she ended up going back to the lifestyle that she had before she became a Christian, which was being an exotic dancer in order to provide for her daughter and herself, which ended up causing her to move into the adult film industry. She made over 200 films, and she wrote a book called From Born Again to Porn Again. And her experience in the church caused her to say, I can't believe this anymore. And then there's Mark. Mark is a high school student who I knew who ended up losing his faith when he went to university. He has deep concerns for the poor and the downtrodden, and he didn't feel like Christianity was actually being lived out in a way, practically speaking, that cared about those folks. So for Mark, it was his values. Now, each one of those people will give you intellectual reasons for why they don't believe. But something happened in their life where the Christian life they were living got shattered in one way or another, and that's what caused them to head down the road of leaving the faith. Now, conversely, if these narrative injuries are destructive, then there's something that you can also listen for that's called a hinge moment. And a hinge moment is when a moment in history when something happens that has an oversized impact on history going forward. So in the same way that a door turns on a hinge and becomes the pivot, hinge moments in a person's life are when life falls apart and then all of a sudden something comes your way and you can rebuild your life again. And when it came to Mike, the hinge moment in his life when things changed was when he went to a retreat because a girl invited him to go on the retreat that he really liked. And so, of course, he went on that. And while he was there, he heard the gospel clearly for the first time in his life. He had people pray for him. And he said that God supernaturally worked in his life in such a way that he broke down in tears. He saw clearly his anger and his hatred towards God. And his life took a totally different direction that day. Dave's hinge moment was different. When he lost his faith in Christianity, he had no faith until he met a well-known atheist. And that well-known atheist took him under his wing and said, look, I can show you a different way to live. And he opened up a world for Dave and made connections for Dave where he became a well-known podcaster and he's made movies and he has a YouTube channel. And Dave now has an entirely different life because there was this hinge moment that pushed him in that direction. It was the influence of one person that stepped into his life that changed it for him. Linda, after making all of these movies, said that what really was the hinge moment for her, there were two in her life. The hinge moment for her was when she found, and this is her claim, more acceptance and love by people in the adult film industry than she did with people in the church. Now, that's one person's experience, and we don't want to indict the entire church for that. And to be quite honest, and I say this with charity and grace, and I hope very little judgment in my voice, I suspect that people in the adult film industry probably have a very low standard for what they're willing to say is wrong or inappropriate, which means they're probably willing to accept almost anyone doing anything. So you have to take that into consideration. But for her, it was when she said that the family of porn was more a family to her than the family of God, and it set her off into that world where she made a life. Several years ago, she got a call that the daughter that she had, who she had given up for adoption, had overdosed on heroin and was about to die. And she said that she broke down, fell on the floor in her bathroom, and wept and cried out to the God that she no longer believed in to save her daughter's life. 10 minutes later, she got a phone call. The doctors say it's a miracle, but your daughter's going to make it. And today, she identifies as a Christian. That was the hinge moment. The second hinge moment in her life where God intervened. Mark's life, well, he went off to college. He went to Berkeley. You know where this story is going to end. He learned about Marxism. And that's what he identifies as today, is a Marxist. That was the hinge moment. He said, here's a new way to live. I can reconstruct this way. Knowing what narrative injuries are, knowing what hinge moments are in a person's life, really important. What is the moment that their faith got shattered? What is the moment when they found a new way to live? Very important to listen to. So the goal in step two is to just listen and to hear and to uncover the reasons that people have for why they believe what they do. Step three, find some common ground. It's hard to have a dialogue with someone if you don't have any common ground with them. Right? The Apostle Paul, when he goes to Greece, and he goes to Athens, and he goes to Mars Hill, and he sees that they're very religious people, he doesn't start out by offending them and telling them that all of their idols are false idols, and he doesn't criticize them for worshiping false idols, but he begins by finding common ground, and he says to them, "Men of Athens, I see that you are very religious." And that he says, "I see all of these gods that are here, and then you have one to the unknown God. Let me tell you who the unknown God is." And he finds common ground with them. Proverbs says that a brother offended is harder to overcome than a fortified city. If Paul had started out any other way, he may not have had an audience and he may not have heard. Finding common ground is important. So what we need to do is we need to look for not just what's wrong in someone's position, but we need to look for what's right. Right? Are they pursuing truth? That's an important thing. I'm pursuing truth too. You're pursuing truth. We've come to different conclusions on this, but that's an important thing. And maybe we need to continue having this dialogue of how you've come to it and how I've come to it. Another one would be to focus on questions and not on answers. And by questions here, I don't mean like peppering them with questions, but I mean the questions that we all care about. Hey, thanks for sharing your story with me. I know it's got to be incredibly hard to go through this. I want you to know that I love you. And I want you to know that those are all the same kind of questions I care about. Like, what is the good life? Where's meaning really ultimately found? How do I really care for and love my family and friends well? How do I be a good person? Those are all the kinds of questions that you're asking as you wrestle with the faith. Those are the same kinds of things that I care about. If we want to have a dialogue, if we want to interact with people, we have to be able to find some common ground and not just see them as an adversary to try and wrestle to the ground and overcome and win and twist their sort of philosophical and religious arms until they're willing to say Jesus, right? We have to be able to love them and treat them as a fellow human being, and we need to find some common values, right? We need to find common values with them. Now, there can be a danger in this to finding so much common ground that you never confront and that you never share what you think the truth is, and we want to avoid doing that, but we don't necessarily want to lead with that. We want to be able to hear what someone has to say. So the goal of step three is just to really foster some dialogue, to be able to have a conversation. Step four. All right, so here's the step where we end up responding to someone. I think it's important before we get to step four that we really do make the commitment that we're going to respond to the person and not necessarily just the position. If I tell you that I'm from California and you tell me you're from Texas, I probably can guess maybe what some of your political views are. You might be able to guess what some of my political views are. If I tell you, you know, that, some other random example of something about myself, you might say, oh, okay, I know where this guy's coming from. And then in the dialogue, what we end up doing is we don't direct our responses to the person. We direct our responses to what we think the position that the person holds is. I could give you a really good profile of somebody who is more likely to deconvert from their faith than a person who is with a different profile who is more likely to remain faithful throughout their entire life. Someone who is most likely to leave their faith is probably between 18 and 30 years old. They might be a bit above average in intelligence. They are open to experience, which means they like trying new things. They are people who have a particular value set that they esteem highly. They value independence. They value, they have a low value of benevolence. They probably have some college. They're more than likely male. There's a handful of characteristics and qualities that if you possess, that Las Vegas would say, given all these, odds are that you're more likely to walk away from your faith than stay in your faith. Now, these are not determinative, But they're similar to a pattern that says if you are maybe overweight, you eat too much sugar, and you never exercise, then you run the risk of getting diabetes statistically. But when I talk with somebody who's in that process, I have to remember that I'm talking to an individual. I'm not talking to the profile. Because I have a general understanding and an idea of where most of the fault lines are for people, where most of the narrative injuries are. Emotion, values, experience, intellect, heart. I know what most of the objections that come, contemporary objections, like how can God exist and there be so much suffering and evil in the world, and how can God be so terrible in the Old Testament but seem to be a pretty okay guy in the New Testament, right? But I have to not discuss and I have to not assume that that's where that person is coming from. I got to make sure that I listen to the person and focus on their objections rather than talk about what I want to talk about. And at some point, I need to just sometimes maybe be able to say, look, it's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that, but I'm willing to get back to you if you want to have a dialogue. All right, so then what is the next thing I should say after I've listened really well, I've heard them out, I have an understanding of where they're coming from? What should I say? That depends on what your goal is. And I think that shouldn't be self-evident that the goal always is to contradict them or to give them apologetic answers. I think there's a time and a place for that for sure. But there are all other alternatives. For example, one, you need to prioritize the issue that you want to address. Prioritize the issue. And then prioritize the issue under the issue. And what I mean by that is, what do you want to do? Do you want to talk to them and respond? Right? Do you want to engage the issue? Someone says, hey, here's why I don't believe. This is where I'm at. Do you want to say, okay, let's talk about that. You don't believe in the existence of God because of X, or you don't believe Jesus rose from the dead because of Y, or you have these problems with trauma and hypocrisy in the church and judgmentalism. Okay, let's talk. That's one response. And maybe your goal is to have that kind of a discussion and a dialogue. And maybe if you're sitting on a bus next to somebody and they're getting off in the next few minutes, maybe that's exactly the goal that you have. You have a very limited amount of time. But if you're in a relationship with someone, don't feel the need to force it. Don't feel the need to have to answer all of the questions and address everything in one instance. In fact, probably that's not the best thing to do, because it makes people feel like, hey, I don't want to talk about this with this person anymore. And the reason why is because every time I get together with them, all they want to do is talk about this issue. So many people who have left their Christian faith have estranged relationships with their parents because they said every time I went over to their house, there was a new YouTube video that was just so happened to be playing on the TV about the very issue that I had complained about them to the week prior. Or they're always suggesting books to read or conferences to come to. So if you have the time, then maybe engaging the issue right on the spot isn't the best thing to do, but maybe it is. Maybe the best thing to do in some situations is just to say, okay, what I'm going to do next is let's determine a process here. Hey, you've opened up to me. You've shared me your struggle with me. I really appreciate it. So how do we want to proceed? Do you want to give me a book? From your perspective, I give you a book from my perspective, and like we meet once a week, and we talk. Do we want to sort of engage in a process of investigation together? Are you willing to have coffee once in a while and continue along this process? That might be the next step for you. It doesn't have to be answering the questions, and it doesn't have to be bringing the person back into the faith instantaneously. Maybe it's you just say, you know what? I don't even think I'm at the stage yet where I can say, let's investigate this together, or let's get books, or let's get together and talk on a regular basis. Maybe I just need to develop the relationship more. Because at this point, I don't have the place. I'm not at the place where I feel like I really can speak with any authenticity and sincerity into this person's life in the way that they're going to hear it. Because I haven't poured myself into them. I think one of the reasons why many people come to faith in Christ isn't because of apologetic answers. In fact, most people come to faith in Christ, they learn apologetics afterwards, right? That's typically how it goes. But most people come to faith because they found someone for whom they enjoyed and liked and were attracted to, who were Christians, who they were willing to let down their guard and hear the story. Because someone loved them enough and poured into their life that they said, hey, maybe there's something here. And so we want to also consider taking that approach too. So step four is you have to make a decision in how you want to respond. Do you want to engage, which is totally fine, and maybe it's appropriate in that moment. You want to maybe perhaps instead determine what the process is going to be. What's the relationship going to be like, and how are you going to engage in this topic going forward? That depends on whether someone's willing to engage with you. And lastly, maybe you just need to say, okay, thanks. But what you need to know is, regardless of where you land on this issue, I love you, and I always will love you, regardless of whether you stay a Christian or you leave the faith, because my love for you is not because we affirm the same positions, but my love for you is because God made you, and God loves you, and you bear his image, and I think Jesus died for you, and so I love you too. So we want to make a wise choice. That's the goal. So to summarize, you find yourself in this conversation. What do you need to do? You need to stay calm. Don't panic. Don't freak out. Step number one, right? We find out, what does the person believe? Step number two, why does the person actually believe it? Number three, try and find some common ground with them so you can have dialogue. And number four, we respond in a way that we think is appropriate, which might or might not include actually addressing the issue on the spot. But all of it needs to be done by expressing love for the person, especially if it's your child or a spouse. Because if you ever hope to have any influence in their life in returning to a faith in Jesus, those lines of communication need to stay open. And the road to communicating, to keeping those lines open, is paved with love. They need to know that your love for them is unconditional, and they can share anything they want with you. Thank you.